Okay, is this good? Okay, turn it off. Yeah, I've gotten two at lunchtime. Oh, it's cask. Okay, this is my lecture on Buddhism, and so far I've talked on Taoism. I'm pretending there are a lot of people out there. an Eastern religion, which has a rather impersonal concept of the ultimate, the Tao, and I've talked on Judaism, which has a very personal concept or experience of the ultimate, who revealed himself to Moses as I am that I am, and not incidentally as a father or mother deity. Buddhism arose out of India, out of a period of a Hindu history, and Buddhism is not a theistic religion. Buddhism is a religion about how to find enlightenment in this world and how to find the answer to suffering. Okay. The word Buddha, you know what that means? Oh, okay, it means enlightened one. And the historical Buddha was named Siddhartha Gautama, and he was in the period of the 6th century B.C., 500s B.C., the exact same period as Lao Tzu in China, and that, and the same period approximately as Socrates in Greece, and that's known as the axial period of history when a number of spiritual geniuses occurred in different places. It was about 500 years before the time of Jesus. Oh, come in. Are you going to? Do you want to attend the lecture on Buddhism? Oh, come in. Okay, let me backtrack a little. I said that that Buddhism arose in India, not China or Japan or anything like that, but in India, which was the place where Hinduism was the already a religion for probably a millennia, and the time period of Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, was the 6th century B.C., 500s B.C., the same as the time of Lao Tzu, and the same as the time of Socrates, too, in Greece. And so he was born in northern India, and he came from the Sakya clan, which was the lion clan. Interestingly, Jesus was from the tribe of Judah. He was a Jew, like myself, incidentally. And that is also a lion. The lion is the symbol of that. So there are some parallels there. If I get into, have time for some parables of the Buddha, I selected some that are almost identical, very similar to parables of Jesus. But back to his story, he was born in northern India, of a tremendously wealthy family. His father was kind of like a king. His name was Suddhodana, and his mother's name Mahadevi, and he was a prince, therefore, and he grew up in tremendous wealth and luxury. And his father wanted to protect him from seeing any of the evils or sufferings of this world, and kept him kind of protected from that, like most people in our kind of society, except poor people, are kind of protected from the kinds of things that you would encounter every day in Bombay: suffering, pain, illness, death, and so forth. So he married at the age of 16. His cousin. They tended to marry within families sometimes those days. his cousin Ruhula, and he had a son at the age of 29. Worked kind of slowly at that, and but he became kind of dissatisfied, and he wanted to see what life was out there in the world, and he asked his charioteer, Channa, to take him out on a tour of what the world out there, outside of the palaces, was like. And this is called The Three Walls. Interestingly, it just occurred to me a couple of days ago, here the future enlightened one, the Buddha, is taken around in the chariot by Channa, who's just a charioteer. In the next session, we'll look at Krishna, who is the charioteer, not the one riding around in it, for Arjuna. So that reverses the things. In any event, the first thing he sees is a man, very old man with long white hair, withered and bent. And the Siddhartha said, "Who is this?" And his charioteer Channa said, "What is this? These are the symptoms of old age. Once a youth, now the years have passed away, and his strength is gone." Okay, and then he goes on, and he sees a man gasping for breath and convulsing in pain. And Siddhartha asked his charioteer, "What is this?" And he said, "This man is sick. We are all subject to the same calamity." Finally, they go on, and they pass four persons who are carrying a coffin, an open coffin with a corpse inside. And Prince Siddhartha was shocked by this and said, "What is this?" And his charioteer answered, "This is a dead man. His life is gone. His thoughts are still. His family and friends are carrying him to the grave." He was stricken with terror. And he said, "Is this the only one, or are there others?" And the charioteer said that this is the same all over the world. People die. So now Siddhartha has encountered old age, sickness, and death, which are called the three woes. And he says this, "Alas, the world is full of darkness and ignorance. There is no one who knows how to cure the ills of existence." He discovers what he calls dukkha, or suffering, which he calls the first noble truth. And we don't like to admit that much, but that was, you know, everyone knows who's lived a long time in this world what suffering is. Then he beholds an image in his mind of a monk-like figure who says, "I am a Samana, troubled at the thought of old age, disease, and death. I have left my home to seek the path of salvation. Everything changes and decays, yet I long for the happiness that does not decay and the treasure that will never perish." So he had this vision, and on the basis of this vision, he decides to exchange his princely robes for the orange or ochre robes of a sannyasin, which is a spiritual seeker or monk who begs for his living. So he goes and takes a last look at his wife and child, and then he goes on, and on a spiritual quest. This was at age 29, and his spiritual quest was about a 7-year period. The first person he meets is a king, Bimbisara, who recognizes him as a prince disguised as a beggar, and offers him a position in the high court. And the future Buddha said, "I can't accept that. I have renounced the ways of the world." And in the history of various spiritual traditions, there are many examples of people like that, spiritual seekers who have renounced the ways of the world. Another good example is Saint Francis of Assisi. There was a movie, Brother, Son, Sister, Moon, in which he had given away a lot of his father's goods to the poor, and his father was a rich, very rich man, and he was infuriated, and he took him to the town square to the bishop to be chastised. But Francis took off all of his clothes and stripped naked and handed it to his father and mother and said, "These are yours, I have no need of them," and then walked naked into the woods, and then eventually founded the his Franciscan order. Well, similarly with Siddhartha. So he went from the King Bimbisara to the Hindu sages of the time called Brahmins, and he studied with them maybe for a year, two named Alara and Udaka, and they taught him the teachings of the Hindu teachings of Jnana Yoga about the Atman, or the soul, that which is immortal in man and never dies, and the I, not that I, but I, behind the seeing and hearing and tasting and feeling, which Hinduism calls the Atman. And that was all fine and good, but Siddhartha felt it didn't answer the problems of human suffering, and he took his leave of the Brahman philosophers. And you'll find that kind of thing in the Upanishads, Hindu scriptures. So he goes to an opposite kind of thing. He goes and joins ascetic monks called bhikkhus, ascetic monks whose spiritual path is extreme deprivation, fasting, and living in the most utterly Spartan circumstances. And he became kind of a master of asceticism, Siddhartha, and became kind of their admired leader, until finally he became totally exhausted and weak, and said, this is not leading me anywhere. This path of extreme asceticism is no more leading me to the enlightenment than the path of indulgence and pleasures and wealth of my life as a prince. So he goes into, takes off his robe and bathes in the river, and then he faints away, and a herdswoman, Nanda, comes and feeds him rice milk, and he takes nourishment for several days and begins to regain his strength, and he kind of decides on the middle way between the extreme asceticism and extreme indulgence, but he heads right for a big and beautiful tree. It really was a banyan tree. It's also called the Bodhi, B-O-D-H-I, Bodhi tree. And he goes and sits and meditates under that tree. And he meditates for 40 days. And he's going to stay there until he receives the enlightenment that he's seeking. Now, while he is sitting there, rather than all kinds of wonderful things, Mara, the evil one, M-A-R-A, Mara, the evil one, similar to Satan in the Judeo-Christian tradition, comes and throws all kinds of torments at him. He's all kinds of evils are he experiences at the hands of Mara, the evil one, and he has three daughters, and one of those daughters is, the three daughters are Tanha, Raga, and Arati. And later, Tanha actually means desire, and that comes into his teaching. His response, you remember the confrontation of Jesus with Satan in the desert, and he tempts Jesus in three different ways, changing bread, stones to bread, jumping off of a tower, and then he tempts him with kind of all of the world, becoming the ruler, sort of temporal ruler of the world, and he rejects that with quotes from scriptures, man shall not live by bread alone, and so forth, and finally says, get thee hence, Satan, thou shalt worship only the Lord thy God. That was the approach of Jesus, quoting Holy Scripture, and the Satan left. Buddha didn't say anything. He just continued his meditation, his meditations, in the state of a clear mind. And so in that, all of the spears and arrows sent by Mara, the evil one, changed to flowers and blossoms, so they had no effect upon him. Sometimes Jesus responded, by the way, with no response, with silence. What was an example of that? Right, he says, you say that I am. Also, Pilate asked Jesus, what is truth? And Jesus remained silent, no response. And Pilate was kind of discomforted by that. And in any event, the meditation of the Buddha, perfect meditation, was enough to, over these 40 days, in which he experienced all of the evils of the world, all of hatred and fear and anger and murder and all kinds of terrible things. He experienced in his mind and consciousness all of the evils of the world during those 40 days. This sitting under the Bodhi tree is somewhat the Buddhist parallel to the much more even extreme example of Jesus crucified, where he experienced the evils of the world unto death. But the story of the Buddha is the sitting under the tree for 40 days, and then he experienced after this confrontation with Mara a supreme enlightenment, and his statement was this: wonder of wonders, intrinsically all living beings are Buddhas, endowed with wisdom and virtue, but because men's minds have become inverted with delusive thinking, they fail to perceive this. The true self or original nature is inherent in all and is perfect. So, not only did he experience enlightenment, but he experienced that all people have that in them, but it's covered up, and what it's covered up by is the ego, and that's what he calls delusive thinking, and so they don't experience that. So, you can comment at any time or ask questions if you have them. Well, okay. His discovery then, well, let's see. Maybe we'll read this together now. I'll start. This is the Buddha upon enlightenment. The Bodhisattva, having put Mara, the evil one, to flight, gave himself up to meditation. All the miseries of the world, the evils produced by evil deeds, and the suffering arising therefrom passed before his mental eye. And he thought, surely if living creatures saw the results of all their evil deeds, they would turn away from them in disgust. But selfhood blinds them, and they cling to their obnoxious desires. They crave pleasure for themselves, and they cause pain to others. When death destroys their individuality, they find no peace. Their thirst for existence abides, and their selfhood reappears in new births. So Buddhism, like Hinduism, believes in a continuing reincarnation, but that isn't a good thing or a great thing, coming back again. We're just coming back again to more and more of the of suffering. It's not necessarily great to keep coming back. You don't know what you might come back to. It might be in Bosnia, being shelled by the Serbs. You might find yourself a slave in Egypt or a, yes. Yes. Okay. You don't have to come back, but in the later Buddhism, there that was there about several kinds of Buddhism, but in a later there's a lesser vehicle Buddhism, Hinayana, and a greater vehicle Buddhism, Mahayana. And Mahayana, the goal is not just individual enlightenment, but to help enlighten the whole world. And so the monks in that take what they call a bodhisattva vow, that even after attaining enlightenment, they'll choose to come back again and again to help others attain enlightenment. So that's so. Thus they continue to move in the coil and can find no escape from the hell of their own making. And how empty are their pleasures, how vain their endeavors, hollow like the plantain tree and without contents like the bubble. The world is full of, that's O-F, evil and sorrow, but it is full of lust. The world is full of evil and sorrow because it is full of lust, desire. Men go astray because they think that delusion is better than truth. Rather than truth, they follow error, which is pleasant to look at in the beginning, but in the end causes anxiety, tribulation, and misery. And then the Bodhisattva began to expound the Dharma. The Dharma is the teaching. It's like in Judaism, the Torah, or in Christianity, the Gospel. The Dharma is the truth. The Dharma is the sacred law. The Dharma is religion. The Dharma alone can deliver us from error, from wrong, from sorrow. Let's skip ahead to the second page. These are the famous Four Noble Truths, Four Noble Truths of the Buddha. These are them. The first noble truth is the existence of suffering, and that is called dukkha. Dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A. Dukkha, suffering, the first noble truth. The second noble truth is the cause of suffering, the cause of suffering. And the cause of suffering, Buddha explained later, is tanha, or desire. And the desire is for things to, is cleaving to things that you want to be permanent. You want wealth, you're poor, you want health, you're sick, you want youth and you're old, you want most of all, your ego to go on forever, but it doesn't. That's the this is a failure to see what he calls anicca, which is impermanence. He said, as scientists would. Don't have what you want, or you have what you don't want, and so on. So this state of desire and the frustration of desires, and most of all this frustration of the desire for your ego to go on forever, is the cause of suffering. The third noble truth is the cessation of sorrow. And the cessation of sorrow is the giving up of tanha, or desire, tanha. And then the fourth noble truth is how to do that, and that's the Eightfold Noble Path. So these four noble truths is the Dharma, this is the truth, this is religion, and let's go into that a little more. You won't have any trouble, probably, in understanding the first noble truth of suffering. That's could be physical suffering, pain, illness, mental suffering, grief, sorrow, loss of loved ones, inevitability of death, and so forth. Not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, and all. All of the unsatisfactoriness of life. So. I think William James, the American philosopher who wrote The Varieties of Religious Experience, said that all religions are really the answer to these words, help, help, kind of the answer to basic suffering of human existence, and what is an answer to that. So, and then the second noble truth, the cause of suffering, it is the failure to realize the truth of impermanence or anicca, and grasping in the constant change for things to be stable, although we have periods of stability and periods of change. I suppose there's no culture ever on earth that has as many things as and offers as many temptations as a modern American culture. Almost everyone wants their computer, two TV sets, one or two cars, your house, and et cetera, et cetera. And we're not really a very happy culture in general. Robert Johnson, who was one of my early teachers, who wrote He and She, and we may know him, spends a lot of time in India. He's about 70 years old or so now. And he said the people in India have almost nothing. They have the barest kind of existence. If they have a roof over their head and enough food to eat every day, that would be pretty good. And they're happy. They tend to be happy people with very little. And we in America tend to be unhappy people with very much. And we always want more. during the Depression, for instance, when the stock market crashed, there were many suicides of former millionaires. They had to have $1 million or something in order to be happy. And, any comments on that? I think that our American culture, not Holden Village, but in general, is uniquely materialistic and grasping of more and more and more things, and constantly shopping in shopping malls is the new recreation, and our highest buildings are always banks, whereas in the Middle Ages the highest buildings were always churches, church steeples. So, McDonald's and the Reader's Digest sweepstakes, the publisher sweepstakes.
Yeah.
Well, if we only had the capitalist free market system, and not over that this veneer of Christianity or some true Christianity and whatever, and other religious values, that would be a very in the teaching of Moses, a very idolatrous system. Mammon and money, the highest good, and for the Buddha, that would be a very delusive and ignorant way of living that would inevitably lead to misery and unhappiness, and so that's a important point, that people who lived much simpler lives tended to be happy, and our immensely complex American lives. I haven't yet gotten my computer, but I eventually will. And why don't you have a computer? How can you write books without a computer? Well, you know, and most of the people I know have them don't write books, and some of the greatest books were written by hand, by a pen, or by Gilgamesh was written in clay. You had to do it fast, and then it hardened. Anyway, we have a American society in which over desire is kind of the way of life, and so and it isn't a particularly happy one. Three, the cessation of suffering. It is possible through the sacrifice of desire. In the early Judaism, there were, and other religions, were animal sacrifices, but the Buddha doesn't require animal sacrifices, just the sacrifice of tanha, or desire. That's pretty hard. So there is an eightfold noble path, and those are right views, right aspirations, right speech, right behavior, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. And go quickly through those. Right views means, for the Buddha, seeing life as it really is, and he says it has three aspects. I don't necessarily agree, by the way, with everything in Buddhism. When I gave my lecture on Taoism, people thought I was a Taoist, and they argued that I wasn't trying to preach and convert you or anything, just the teaching aspect. I'll get into that later. But for the Buddha, the three aspects are anicca, or impermanence, dukkha, or suffering, and the third, anatta, or egolessness, or no self. He takes a kind of opposite view to the Hindu traditional teaching of Atman, or the soul or self. The Buddha says no self is the reality. I don't know if I agree with that, but number two, right aspirations means weeding out of evil desires and motives, like motive to hurt others, motive to steal, motive to lie, and replacing them with the virtuous motives like kindness and generosity. Right speech, not lying, speaking truly. Right behavior, and that right behavior means behavior with a clear mind rather than a disturbed mind. And right behavior produces good karma, bad karma. So, and then right livelihood, five, and that is earning a living in a moral or ethical way. And the Buddha had a Ten Commandments too that are fairly similar to the Moses' Ten Commandments, not identical. And one of them is not killing, and it refers to all sentient beings in Buddhism. So one couldn't be a butcher and engage in right livelihood, or even a soldier and kill and engage in right livelihood. Although, as the Buddhism developed in over the millennia, there were many samurai who did kill and who felt they were Buddhists. And then in Christianity, even though Jesus taught a very pacifistic ethic, if someone hits you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also, and so on, the crusaders who slaughtered Muslims and Jews considered themselves to be very good Christians. So it shows you how far from the original teachings the religions can get. Right livelihood, right effort implies developing the willpower to overcome bad habits of a lifetime, not only things like smoking and overeating, but neurotic behavior patterns, obsessions, compulsions, fears and phobias, depression, and finally overcoming the tanha or desire. And then seven, right mindfulness, and this is almost like psychotherapy, right mindfulness, becoming aware of your, say, body awareness, and there are Eastern disciplines like yoga that develop a body awareness particularly, whereas our kind of Western calisthenics and bodybuilding and stuff is not so much into that. In Tai Chi, and then awareness of fear, depression, anger. So here's now
the epitome of meditation for the Buddhist is Zen Buddhism. And Zen monks, which is true Zen Buddhism, for instance, devote sometimes an entire day, a day after day, to sitting in lotus posture, meditating, or getting up, walking, doing walking meditation. Or doing something Zen archery meditation, flower arrangement, or the tea ceremony in Japan, and so forth. All of these things were meditation. The basic one is sitting in lotus posture and I was thinking of doing that at the beginning, but if we did, then you wouldn't want to hear the lecture because the meditation would be better than the lecture. So that's the high teaching is meditation. And it's pretty simple. If you can't sit in the lotus posture on the cushion, then you can simply sit upright chair and put your hands like this, a right hand underneath, left hand on top, and then join your thumbs together. And just meditate on your breath. Believe it or not, that was only about 50 seconds. Typically, in Zen centers, they meditate 40 minutes twice a day, 40 minutes in the morning and 40 minutes at night. But I suggest that my book will rest much too long for beginners, so try 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes in the night, and you'll experience a state of clearness and calmness, and eventually this is really called insight meditation, in theme. So while you're meditating, whatever the, if there's any noise, just continue to meditate around you. Your thoughts arising, simply continue to meditate. Don't worry about stopping the thoughts. That's pretty impossible. That's like but not trying to take it to take elements or some just trying not to take it to take elements and do that, but simply let the thought arrive and whatever, and then continue to meditate. One master of meditation is Zen Master Uchiyama Roshi said, the aim of doing zazen, zazen is the name of Zen meditation, is to do zazen. It is not done for some purpose. Zazen itself is Satori. Satori is the enlightenment in Japan. Let me read what Hermann Hesse, the German novelist, wrote a wonderful book called, sorry about that, Siddhartha. Siddhartha, and that's kind of loosely on the story of the Buddha, that he reached enlightenment at a river, by being a river boatman crossing the river every day. But here's what Hermann Hesse says. Who is the real Buddha? Hermann Hesse describes him poetically. He seems to be smiling gently inwardly. With a secret smile, not unlike a little child, he walked along peacefully, quietly. He wore his gown and walked along exactly like the other monks, but his face and his step and his peaceful downward glance spoke of a peace, a completeness, seeking nothing, imitating nothing, reflecting a continual quiet, an unfading light, an invulnerable peace. An invulnerable peace. Jesus said something similar to that. He said, I shall give you a peace which surpasseth understanding. Here was a dialogue that the Buddha was supposed to have had with someone who came to question him, and a disciple. Now, he was age 36, by the way, at the time of his enlightenment, so the 7 year plus, and he wasn't sure whether he wanted to just enjoy his enlightenment or whether to teach others, and he decided to teach others, and he went around India for 44 years until his death at age 80, preaching his Dharma, and he attracted disciples. And they formed a Buddhist community called Sangha. So if you were to become a Buddhist, I'm not trying to convert you, I'm not a Buddhist by the way, but you take refuge in the Buddha, take refuge in the Dharma, that's the teaching, and take refuge in the Sangha, that's the community. This was the disciple's questions to the Buddha. He said, are you a god? Buddha said, no. Are you a spirit? Buddha said, no. Are you an ordinary man? Buddha said, no. Buddha said, no, old disciple, that I have completely annihilated individualism. No, old disciple, that I am the Buddha, meaning the enlightened one. I am the perfected one. I have obtained nirvana. I am awake. I am awake. That's the key statement there. I am awake. So, yes.
And
Chris talked about karma,
it's a desire
to get into karma. I suppose it would, but I don't think he would be against marriage and reproduction things, but making that an obsession, some sex obsession. We have a lot of that in our society too. San Francisco.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let me go to the pen. Here it is. Okay. Here are the Buddhist the Ten Commandments. Okay. kill not, but have regard for life. Steal not, neither do you rob, but help everybody to be a master of the fruit of his labor. And three, you'll have to interpret it for me, abstain from impurity and lead a life of chastity. What does that mean? I don't think that necessarily means that don't marry. Right. But a Buddhist monk, when they are monks, are chaste, but they often don't take lifetime vows, because the period can be 3-5 years, and when they follow the monastic life, and then they quite free when they attain what they wish to leave that, and then marry, live the life of the household. So the monastic vows often are not a lifetime, like in the Catholic Church. Four, lie not, but be truthful. Five, invent not evil reports, neither do you repeat them. Talk not, but look for the good side of your fellow beings, so that you may, with sincerity, defend them against their enemies. Five, six, swear not, but speak decently with dignity. Seven, waste not the time of gossip, but speak to the purpose or keep silent. Eight, covet not, thou shalt not covet, covet not, nor envy, but rejoice at the fortunes of other people. Nine, cleanse your heart of malice, cherish no hatred, not even against your enemy. Very similar to Jesus. Love your enemy. Ten, free your mind of ignorance and be anxious to learn the truth, especially in the one thing that is needful. So those are the Buddhist Ten Commandments. Okay, that's a good question. I have the answer to that. It's spread by a Indian Buddhist monk named Bodhidharma. He was from India in the 6th century A.D., Bodhidharma, and he traveled to China and brought Buddhism from India to China. And I'll give you one of the sayings, yes, wonderful sayings, books, extant books by him and many of his then teachers, and all of them, many of them, they take care. If you wish to seek the Buddha, this is Bodhidharma, you ought to see into your own nature, for this nature is the Buddha itself. If instead of seeing into your own nature, you turn away, seek the Buddha in external things, you will never get at him. That was the man in India, who brought, and then there was a school developed of that, and Buddhism spread all through China, and then it eventually spread, it was Zen, Chan, Buddhist, which somehow comes from Dhyana, means meditation, translate, Dhyana, Chan, something like that. But when it spread to Japan, it became Zen, and then spread all over Asia, Korea, Buddhist countries became China, Japan, Korea, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Tibet, precious kind of Buddhist stuff, but Vajrayana Buddhism, that's a big story there. Anyway, in most of the countries of Asia, Buddhist spread, and it kind of died out for some reason. I don't know if it's persecuted or whatever, in India. Although India, Hindus are the most tolerant religion, rather than only have one Christ nation, they have a very much more serious incarnation of God in the eighth form of Krishna, and when they spell Buddha, because it would be another incarnation of God, and so they sort of assimilated that, but Buddhism takes place left India, and Hinduism, it returns in the form of the Tibet Buddhist exile from Tibet, the Chinese communist in